Welcome back to Walking Away from Arcadia. This is Simon, and my co-host Victor is here as well. And today we're going to revisit a topic that has seen the landscape change a little bit since C20 came out and we had done our initial episode about it. Today we're going to be talking about glamour and banality. Glamour hasn't changed terribly much. But banality has had some refinement, and it's worth talking about it again. Victor had an observation about the fan reaction to the new banality definitions, so I'm going to let him go with that.
Yeah, so one of the big changes in C20 is in previous versions of Changeling, science, big S umbrella, science and technology, was presented as banal. And there was a little bit of a weirdness around that with knockers and goblins. But with knockers and goblins, it was kind of hand waved away as, oh, well, they're doing crazy chimerical things. That's not real science, so it's not banal. And C20 came along and it made banality personal. It made banality something that you have an intimate relationship with, and the things that are banal to you might be different from the things that are banal to another changeling. Kind of the classic example, because they're similar in a couple ways but really different, are boggins and knockers. All that new modern technology could be very banal to a boggin, but it probably isn't going to be to a knocker. Even within boggins, one boggin might be into accounting and law and, office gossiping. I could very easily see, the perfect grump boggin that would thrive in that environment be able to slough off the environmental banality and not actually trigger that much in that setting because it worked for them, but a different, more homey, chef, traditional boggin would absolutely be undone by that setting. They created that. It's kind of nice. It adds a more diversity. One thing that I saw, and I had this conversation with a few players, were people that just insisted, oh no, now science isn't banal at all. And, we looked at the opening banality intro in C20, and it talks about disbelief. It talks about the force of reason and reasoning away supernatural threats. It talks about stagnation. And all of those things still have a place in the world of science. It's just science isn't automatically banal. And so I figured it would be worth sort of talking through the weirdness there, because it's really not that science is never banal now. It's just that it isn't banal by default.
Yeah, the thing I think is most helpful in sort of judging whether science is banal or glamorous or maybe gray area for changelings is to place changeling a little bit more strongly in the World of Darkness canon, especially in the mage context, because a lot of the way banality is described in C20 lines up with the technocratic paradigm. Not perfectly, but it gets real close sometimes. And looking at the Ascension War and talking about, whether something is consensus or not, or whether something is technocratic paradigm or not, gives you some of the shades of whether or not something might be at least relatively banal, if not objectively banal.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot. And you kind of can't get away from the fact that the Shattering aligned with the rise of the Order of Reason. I mean, the timing of those two things basically coincide perfectly. Like, the Daedalans came into existence, they began manipulating human society, and they kind of caused the Shattering. And there are reasons for that. Their primary goal was not elevate this new potential and wild new crazy things that we can do with this science stuff that sort of came along with it. That was maybe a side goal, but their primary goal was codify and control reality to make it safer and more predictable and push all of these horrible supernatural things that feed on humanity out into the outskirts of non-existence where they belong. that was the goal of the Daedalans. And that's the root of a lot of science, actually. Going back, it was about illuminating the darkness and making superstition go away and give way to reproducible, controllable constants to make the world safer for humanity. That's kind of terrible for changelings.
Yeah, in the Dark Ages context, even in Dark Ages Fae, the pieces are there. They're just not super well illuminated to take that step. The Sundering is all about the Fae having ignored the real world and humanity. But the Shattering is about humanity turning its back on the Fae in return. And at least in my table canon, the high point of the Shattering isn't like the existence of cold iron. It's the culmination of the, nation technocratic effort and really forcing the idea into at least consensus that the world itself is self-evident, self-completing, it's a sphere, you can't get out of it. Before that, especially in like mythology and hero stories, people would walk out of the real world and walk back in all the time. But if the world is round and self-contained, you can't.
Yeah, I still remember, and I forget exactly which of your sort of homebrew documents that write-up is in, but when I read what you wrote about the self-containing of reality and that being the shattering, and it does line up with discovering the new world, and yes, the whole idea that everyone thought the world was flat before the European discovering of the new world is a bit of a myth. But still, like, that was kind of the final, yes, this is, we can travel this, we can do this. And it just really hit me when I read that write-up that you did. And it's interesting because that kind of lines up with the Exalted canon as prequel, if you want to use that, because in Exalted, you do. You're walking around reality, creation. That's great. You wander out of reality into the wild. And when you wander into the wild, you are among the fair folk. Almost invariably, the fair folk will populate any wild pocket, the edge of creation. And, it's just that idea that upon becoming round, you can no longer do that is really kind of powerful.
And it ties into the resurgence later, where humanity finally escapes the safe little cage we made for ourselves, and the idea that science isn't necessarily banal, because at its core, the resurgence was humanity reaching out and making, if not the world, our understanding of where we are and where we could be much larger.
Well, and it's interesting, and this gets into more heavily crossover content idea than really just for Changeling, but people have always brought up in the Changeling fandom, like, wait, science is banal, but we land on the moon and that's what brought about the resurgence? What? And that never gelled, and it is really awkward. If you had to pick one corner of the technocratic union that's really not terribly banal, it's the void engineers. And the interesting thing, going back to that, oh, the world is round, you can't walk into the wild now, is as soon as you open up the spirit realms, as soon as you can go off planet, then it becomes possible to go back to those places. And I feel like everyone focuses on the, oh, people thought about the possibility and opened up wonder again. And that's an important angle in Changeling. And that was kind of a major turning point for science becoming less about codifying and making the world safe and more about careening towards new possibilities, which is what makes it work for Changelings. But there's also something very symbolic about we are going to go back into the dark depths now. The dark places of reality where the things we've forgotten might exist. And there's a description in one of the mage books about, okay, so if reality is defined by consensus, how do werewolves and, vampires and all of these things exist? Changelings are a little different because they have to really actively hide from consensus. But what about all these other creatures that don't? And it was basically described as, well, there's what everyone admits they believe. And then there's what everyone is afraid exists, and they can't quite talk themselves out of believing it entirely in their darkest of darkest nightmares. And that's harder to get rid of. And that's the little corner of consensus reality where vampires and werewolves and ghosts exist. And the idea of we're going to go back out into the wild now and we can make it being a point of resurgence is an interesting framing.
Plus, there are those two-ish groups of technomancers that are part of the traditions, the Society of Aether now. And did the virtual adepts change their name?
The Mercurial Elite. Unlike the Society of Aether, you're better off just calling them virtual adepts. Mercurial Elite is not a term that is much loved in the mage fandom.
Oh, too bad. So the Society of Aether and the Virtual Adepts, both of which encompass at least the possibility of larger world. I think it was the Society of Aether that, in canon, came up with the idea of the Hollow Earth, which is again an opening up of what was a discrete quantity. And the Virtual Adepts, at least in the mage I remember, it may have changed more recently. We're all about transhumanism and exodus into new space.
Yes, they're still about that. It's a little less 90s tropey. They were reined in a little 'cause they didn't age well of all the traditions, but that's still more or less what they're about. They're just a little less campy about it.
And those two groups, depending on what their particular paradigm and goals were, always struck me as a couple of prodigals that would have mixed with the right type of fae pretty well.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the idea of the Society of Aether and the Knockers having a really substantial relationship and it not being banal at all is really compelling. I also think by moving supernaturals away from their sort of strict banality assignments, because previous editions had this chart, this is how banal an average human is, this is how banal a mage is, unless they're one of these two groups, this is how banal a vampire is. I think it opens it up a lot more to have more nuanced conversations about what is banality and what is inspiration, because mages were always defined as really banal in the old editions, except for like dream speakers and cultists. And the argument for that, which I do understand, is that mages codify reality. Even the non-techno mages, they look at reality and they tell reality, this is what I want you to be. Right now, in this moment, transform into my vision and be that and nothing else. And that's kind of antithetical to the Fae, and I get that argument. But at the same time, the Avatar is described as inspiration, and they fundamentally create new things. Like, even the Technocratic Union, they're pushing the timeline, and they are perpetually and constantly transforming reality into new potential, and they're doing it at a really frenetic pace at this point. And the you're going to be exactly what I tell you is kind of banal, but there's a huge amount of inspiration in the mage model as well, and that's what the Fae feed on. So I feel like I want there to be a much more dangerous, seductive, powerful, but maybe deadly dance between mages and Fae. And that's not necessarily what's been written.
Yeah, the banality chart. The banality chart was always something I hated. And, like, the quintessential example of the banality stereotypes that pissed me off the most was for vampires, Malkavians were extremely low banality. And on the one hand, I can see that because they have that sixth sense prophecy thing going on. On the other hand, especially in second edition and first edition Changeling, a lot of the banality powers of the Autumn People lined up real close with compulsive disorders, which Malkavians, not all Malkavians, but Malkavians would express their vampire weakness insanity through. It never made sense to me that that would be not banal when it comes from a Malkavian, but it would be banal if it came from an Autumn person.
Yeah, I totally agree there. And I think that gets back to a whole Malkavian problem in terms of the Malkavians are expressed really poorly. They're basically all run as moon touched. And if you want to run the Malkavians as the medieval concept of lunacy and just be like, that's what they are and run with it, that's fine. But that's not the system of how they're put together. They're put together as they each have their own personal derangements. And some of those would be really banal. Like the traveling salesperson, like she would be really banal, really profoundly banal. Some of the canon Malkavian characters are total changeling bane. Like they're not screaming, nutty, moon-touched oracles, they're creepingly sociopathic, unrelatable machines. And that's their insanity. Like, sociopathic, unrelatable in a way that even makes, thousand-year-old Ventru be like, ooh, you're giving me the willies. So, yeah, that chart was such a mess in so many different ways. I mean, I still think 99% of technocrats I would run as being very banal, but I'd have that 1%, that like crazy imaginative progenitor, that even that random weird iteration X guy that totally works with knockers, maybe like a third of the void engineers, as not being ridiculously banal because there's potential there and it makes sense. Again, technocrats aren't really using science in the way that real world means science, and that gets weird if you want to play Changeling and you aren't deeply invested in the rest of the World of Darkness canon, because I feel like Changeling leans really heavily on broad cosmological truths that were built in the previous games, but it doesn't actually build out or inspect those truths itself. And so for people who play it as a standalone game, I think some of the pieces are missing. In the earliest days, the Tuatha De Danann and all their kind moved like sunlight on the land. They held their bright dreams aloft in slender fingers and carried them to dank caves where the mortals huddled, plagued with nightmares. From their light, the Tuatha nourished human folk, inspired them to dream newer, brighter visions. But they were not the only ones who dreamed so. It is said that Nule the Blue discovered the siblings in a clearing. One night, a star fell from high above and crashed into a grove. Nule traced its fall with wonder. When we went to see the ruin, Nule found four youths, two girls, two boys, whose eyes shimmered in the twilight. Unlike the drab mortals Nule had met before, these weavers crafted dreams from waking thought. As they did so, the land around them changed, the very air glimmered where they stood, and it crackled with potent glamour. Aroused, yet terrified, Nule ran to fetch his cousins. Intrigued, they returned with him in multitudes. "Who are you?" Nule demanded. "We have never seen your kind before, and you are like us? Like mortals, or like some other thing?" One sister spoke. "We are prime, the offspring of the flame." Her sister spoke. "We are earth, the children of the clouds." One brother spoke. "We are craft, the shapers of the world." His brother spoke. "We are the end and the beginning. We are all." "Nonsense," replied Queen Rhaen, the leader of the horde. But the others hesitated. There was truth in what the children said. "Prove what you say,"
the foolish queen continued, or we will take you back to the caves where you belong. The children only laughed. You call yourselves the givers of dreams, said the first sister. We will dream for you, then, dreams of our own creation. We shall see who sends whom to the caves, proud one, and who passes on wonder to our folk. So saying, the first child dreamed like fire. Her eyes glowed like sowin embers, and she spoke in nonsense tones. At her laughing cry, the air became a furnace. The Tuatha burned at its touch, and they fled the child. Safely away, they called her Te the Mad. The second child's voice was like light, and her dreams were winds. Like a breeze she spoke, and the air grew clear. Like a hurricane she roared, and the wind swept the fairies away. Her words carried comfort, joy, and wrath. Those who heard them said, "Tempt not her anger." And they named her Lee the Shadow. And the third child's dreams were stone. Her words grated like pebbles on slate, and they weighed so heavily that the air became mud, and the mud became a prison. Some Tuatha stood too near the child, and he wrapped them screaming in dark stone prisons. Try as they might, no one could free the captives. In time, they expired and joined the stone. "He is anathema," the survivors cried, and they called him Ihen, the Iron Maker. The fourth child's dreams bubbled up from the sundered ground. The sky wept as he capered and spit. His eyes were dark, savage waters, like whirlpools or mad tides. His voice was sweet, poisoned water, delightful to taste, but deadly to swallow. He beckoned some fae on a merry dance, then turned on them like a griffin and split their bones to slivers. "He is wonder," said the Shadow Kith. "He is a demon," said their bright cousins. They all decided he was both, and they named him Challa, the Unbound. Queen Rain turned to stone beneath the ground. Nul the Blue burned at the Mad One's touch. The surviving Tuatha gathered far from the clearing and discussed the children for many long nights. Finally, it was decided that the siblings should be left alone. The Tuatha would seek them out when the time seemed right. But until then, the children would be left to blaze in their own paths. In time, the siblings grew, mated, and had children of their own. Some fairies courted these magical offspring, drinking their glamour like fine wine. Others fled their sight, and still others sought revenge. Bargains were struck, alliances entered, and bitter enmities cast. The temperamental siblings bred temperamental offspring, and each soon warred against the others. As the Silver Age became bronze, and the Bronze Age became iron, the awakened dreamers took their cousins by the hands and led them from the caves. The mortals cast our dreams aside, and the children of the fallen star wove their own spells on the land. Ages later, their gifts have different shapes, but still rework the world. Behold them, for they dream in an awakened state. Befriend them, for even the dullest of their kind breathe glamour like the air. Beware them, for that glamour is potent enough to destroy the highest fairy king. These are the children of the fallen star. Dance in their footsteps, but stay clear of their sight.
Starts to get us neatly into what's changed in C20 about banality, and the big change has been that banality is no longer an objective force in the universe that is oppressing you. It is, on one level, there are objective sources of banality. On another level, there are sorts of cultural sources of banality. What is banal or expressing disbelief or a shutting down of reality to an indigenous fae is different from what would be those things to a member of the dominant community who happens to be fae. And then on a third level, there are also personal banality triggers, things that affect your character and maybe none of the other ones at the table.
This is actually one of the changes I like the most in C20. My only complaint about it is that there's not enough of it. And C20 was pretty tight on the word count. They put a lot of stuff in that book, and the banality triggers is one of the coolest new ideas. I'd really like to see it in the Changeling Player's Guide that we're probably going to get in another year and a half, 2 years. I'd really like to see banality triggers get like two, three times the word count that they got in C20. But the idea of that, even just giving you that that framing can be relative, I think is really useful. The examples given aren't expansive, and it's a little mushy, with the exception of your antithesis, which is one absolutely solid personal banality trigger. There's kind of an abstract, like there's a list of banality triggers. Some of them are fixed, like destroying Chimera, unless you're a wild or on a quest. But there's like some language that says it's up to the ST what's going to be a banality trigger for your character. And that's useful. I like the framing. I'd like a little bit more system to kind of sink my hooks into there. But it's enough for me to roll with at my table.
I found the banality trigger system to be a really natural outgrowth from playing with Dark Ages Fae, because in Dark Ages Fae, you have echoes, which are a little bit different from what they are in modern Changeling. In Dark Ages Fae, echoes are expressions of disbelief or traditional remedies against supernatural curses or meddling that your character specifically finds repellent. And they were always framed as being extremely cultural and extremely personal. And, Matt McFarland worked on both projects, so I think I get where this came from. And at our table, we've been running with just players choosing or making up their echoes. And in Dark Ages Fae, the sample echoes list is not particularly inspiring. But the framing around the idea was enough that well before C20 came out, we kind of engineered the banality trigger idea and we just didn't call it that. The systems seem very contiguous to me, and I like that as a point of continuation between not always acknowledged prequel to the modern period.
I think that that connection between echo and banality is the more obvious connection for most players. It's the thing that resonates with them. I think the other half of banality, which is ignored a lot, is the weaving half. And we talked about this a little bit in our last banality episode, banality and glamour episode, where in Dark Ages Fae, you could become weaving imbalanced, where you lost some of the wild potential of being a Fae. And by Dark Ages Fae standards, all modern changelings are kind of ultimately weaving imbalanced. And that banality is this kind of mixture between disbelief and stagnation and too much structure. And like in the Adheen book, it says the Adheen have no banality, but they kind of do. They have a little bit, or they couldn't even hold form. And so I think that's the other side of banality that is in the stagnation bit. That idea of being dragged down by responsibility and focus and drive. And one thing that they did interestingly, as kind of a segue to the last part of triggers, is they now have seeming triggers where you have a fixed trigger that you absolutely get in your seeming, and you have a fixed banality immunity that you get in your seeming. And you don't get to choose them. It's not like there are an array of wilder ones and an array of grump ones. They're the same for everyone. I'd like that to be a little more dynamic, but it's telling that the grump immunity is immunity from prolonged exposure to banal people and places. Because, and I forget exactly what the threshold is in C20, if you spend too much time in a banal location or around banal people, even if they don't say anything that causes a specific trigger, you basically just trigger. Except grumps don't. And it creates this interesting space because in previous editions, grumps were like kind of write off, like, oh, you're not long for this world. we're just kind of biding time until you're undone. But in C20, they've been written as having this bit of resilience. Like, I'm a grump. They kind of have hibernality. But now I don't gather it as quickly. Like, I'm able to hold this place for longer. And I think that that's interesting. I think that that transforms a lot of changeling social dynamics in ways that I'm sort of looking forward to getting inspected over the next few years.
I think we've talked about this before, but in case we haven't, the seemings are no longer chronological age linked. You can be a childer who is 50. You can be a grump who is 10. It's about your perspective, and paradigm isn't exactly the right word. It's more about your mechanism for resilience, I think, based on the triggers and the immunities. They seem to point at perspective and coping mechanisms more than they do why you think the world is the way it is.
Yeah, and they captured some of that in the Changeling Ready-Made Characters book. You know, I don't do a lot with the Ready-Made Characters books, but I do find that they're interesting places to find ideas and to get kind of perspective on what the developers and writers think about the game and how they would go about playing it, because these are ultimately the characters they put together. And there are characters where in second edition, they would absolutely not be the seeming that they're presented as. They're the wrong age. It's kind of folded into their story. And it is an interesting perspective on the way the seemings work now. Even if you wouldn't necessarily use any of those characters directly, I think that there are some interesting ideas there.
The other link that Benali triggers have to previous editions of Changeling is they're a bit of a dark mirror on the musing thresholds. The thresholds were always a sort of glamour can be personal marker for me. I didn't love the old system for figuring out what your musing threshold was or what your ravaging threshold was and how they didn't really do anything. I thought they were a neat role play element, but they never really went anywhere for me. And C20 never really got around to updating that idea either. But now that it has that twin idea in triggers, it helps to bring into focus more that the whole idea that the Fae are kind of dying out, while it is definitely true from some perspectives, what are they being replaced by, if they're being replaced by anything? Are they being replaced by banality, or are they being replaced by new sorts of chimerical things that aren't necessarily objectively banal, but are banal to extant changelings? The Vulpeltinge is a really clear example of that to me, because of their freehold killing innate flaw. Like, they are clearly a thing of the dreaming, and yet they are really, really toxic to something that's really important to the changelings who've been around forever.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting space to explore, especially now that they've put the Create a Kith concept in. There've been some fiction stories in the anthology that deal with new and different kiths, and the Vorpeltinger have been translated. They were non-English language only books, so they were one of the translations that C20 got to pull them into the main canon, which was kind of nice. But the idea that they were Chimera recently and that they became Kith, that they were able to go through the Changeling way, just the fact that that's an official possibility now does create some really interesting spaces, especially because, speaking of new banal things, C20 also introduced Cold Iron Chimera that are objectively banal. But if there is this end of Chimera that can be objectively, like, we use stigmas, banal, when you get into the mushy, may not be banal to everyone's base, that leaves some really interesting possibilities. And it also opens up some really interesting biases that I think characters would have that may not be accurate. It's just a point of view thing.
So one place that C20 I feel missed the mark a little bit was while Benally triggers are great, at least I think they're great, I think they're a great addition to the game, and the seemings, to be completely honest, I'm probably not going to use them as written, maybe ever, except for maybe one shot. But they've got some good ideas in them, especially the seeming trigger and the seeming immunity. They don't map well onto the non-Kithane groups. This kind of ties into a critique I've had of the Nunahi since I noticed it. They don't have revelries, which is kind of weird. Like, I can make a really convoluted argument as to why that is, and it doesn't rely on Control C, Control V, but I think that's really convoluted, and I think the simpler explanation is probably the right one, and that's just that not a whole lot of effort was put into porting them forward. The whole new banality trigger system and the banality immunity system doesn't map well to the Gallane, and I can't really put that all on. I don't want to put that on intent.
Like, I've looked at the revelries thing, and we're working at hashing out actual revelries for the Nunahi just as a house rule thing. But I think the revelries weren't moved forward to the Nunahi because musing wasn't pulled forward for the Nunahi. And I think it's just like, oh, we want to make them entirely animist. The old musing dynamics for the Nunahi were not great. They were weird and culturally specific in a way that didn't make sense. Like, why are the Nunahi limited when other Fae aren't? When those other Fae come from cultures as well. So, I mean, I didn't love the old musing rules, but at the same time, just removing them completely, which C20 did, then leaves them without the kind of space where the revelries exist, and so I think that's why they didn't include them. But that's a pretty big hole. So, yeah, I have very mixed feelings about that. I don't think it's intent. I think it's just resources, and they needed the Nunahi and the Menahune specifically. Just they need a native author, and they need a whole book to explore and to sort of stretch out. I think that there's work that can be done to make them better and more playable and less sort of weird and reductive, but there's a fair bit of effort involved in that process.
Actually, I never thought of that. Did the non-native Gallane end up with revelries?
Yes, they did. They're
Well, then that's
weird
just.
revelries in a lot of cases, but they do have them.
Well, then that's just bullshit because some of those are really, really animist.
Yeah, like the Gillydew having a revelry is weird because they'd have the same reason to not have it that the Nunahi do, but I'm pretty sure that the Gillydew have a revelry. Like, as an example, the Oba are given the same revelry as the Ishu. The Oba can't travel.
Well, that's functional.
It's really bizarre. I mean, they can use the
Oh.
storytelling half of that revelry, I guess, but it invokes the whole revelry in their write-up, and they cannot leave the land they're tied to. And it's just like, what?
Yeah, and the inanimate don't have revelries either, even though they can feed from inspiration, unless that changed.
They can still feed from inspiration. It's a weird random thing they don't really have a lot of control over. Someone happens to be near my anchor and they were inspired. Yay, glamour. I mean, it's weirdly random, but yes, the inanimate don't get revelries either.
Yeah, I think that's really oversight, 'cause it's not even consistent across the Gallane.
Yeah, well, the other thing is I don't think the Thelane have revelries. Yeah, I'm looking at the Thelane now, and they don't have revelries either. Now, it can be argued that that's because the Thelane are not meant to be player characters, and so a revelry, what value does it really add? But it is still a bit of an oversight because they more or less function as the Cathayne in all other manners.
That's interesting too, because they went through the work of doing Thelane specific seemings and seeming triggers and seeming immunities, didn't they?
They did. The triggers for the Thelane with the Childer equivalent, which is a perturbed, they invite banality when she goes along with a new experience or spends extended time in an unfamiliar location while not in pursuit of her legacy's urge, which is really weird. I mean, I
It's
think the
exactly the
Cathay.
opposite of the Cathayne.
It is, and I think it's supposed to be invoking like that troublesome, like super hard-headed kid that doesn't want to ever try or do anything new. But for a fae, even a dark fae, like that doesn't really make a lot of sense. I'm not a fan of that trigger. Their immunity is if something does not please a perturbed, it does not deserve to exist. Destroying any kind of dross, chimerical item, or treasure never triggers banality. For like a horrible, terrifying NPC villain, I'm okay with that immunity. I think that's actually, there's a lot of meat there for having Cathayne, which bind the dreaming precious. Just seeing a fae thing go through and just ravage it and not face any repercussions. I like the impact that would have on players. So I like their immunity. I don't really like their trigger very much.
And their immunity is kind of a mirror of the Wilder immunity, not getting banality triggered from killing Chimera in pursuit of their quest.
Yeah, the difference is it's absolute, which is, yeah, I mean the Wilder one at least has a has that in pursuit of their quest control on it that a judicious storyteller can use to keep their players in check. I've seen several people imply that that immunity is much more broadly applicable than I would probably treat it at my table. So I think that's a rule that's likely to get some abuse at some tables. But, you know, golden rule, play the way you want to play. But yeah, the Thelane version is just unfettered. The Wilder one is passing up an opportunity to fulfill his urge or gather dark glamour triggers banality. So basically, any time that you avoid selfishness, just doing the most selfish thing. That actually makes sense to me, the way the Thelane are written. And then their immunity is that they don't gain banality through ravaging a rhapsody.
Which also
That,
makes sense for NPCs and what the
yeah.
Thelane are.
It does. It's a little weird to me actually that that doesn't apply to the Thelane broadly, but you know, Wilder are what you're going to run into most often. And then for Grump, a miser risks banality if she ever loses anything she considers hers. That actually lines up with some dark fairy tales, and they kind of lean on this like weird obsessive possessiveness, and I definitely see where that gets invoked in some old fairy stories, so I kind of get that. And then the immunity is a miser knows trespassers should never be tolerated. She's not triggered for killing any mortal, chimera, or changeling who violates her property without permission. That's actually not a terribly applicable immunity. Like, there's a little bit in the destroying chimera or Cathayne, I suppose, because those can be banality triggers. But that's a lot less compelling than the other immunities.
The miser trigger is pretty much the opposite of the grump trigger. The grump trigger being that they are triggered by failing to care for their charges. And that's like they try to put some qualifiers and clauses in there after it, but it kind of comes across a little doormatty to me the way they wrote it. That may just be me projecting, but I might not be the only person who reads it that way.
Yeah, the immunities for the regular Cathayne, I like most of the immunities for the Cathayne. Again, they don't map to the Ghislaine terribly well, especially the wilder ones about being on a great noble quest and all of these things wrapped up in your quest. And it's great if you're living in a Shakespearean story, but if you're a Gillydew or an Ali'i, like if you're a Wilder Ali'i or an Oba, and you're tied to your place and you're tied to, the people you're leading and your role as a leader, even as a Wilder, that doesn't make any sense. Like, an Ali'i could never go out and just like, I'm gonna go out and quest. It's like, no, you're our freehold buddy. You're not going anywhere. So there's some space there that needs expansion.
I wonder, how would creation defend itself were we to come tomorrow? A shield, perhaps. Could Nirakara itself be hardened against us? Interesting, but doubtful. Perhaps a weapon, like the one their empress used. A hateful, graceful scourge that thirsts for blood. Better yet, an object of desire, something alluring and distracting. Aloof, yet attainable. Could the creation born dream up such a wonder? No, they'll rely on armies, mortals skilled in combat. Bred for hard work. Such armies are levies against the unsubtle tides of the wild. Better then to insinuate rather than overwhelm. Better to lure and give pleasure and bind from the shadows. Of course, I should not be careless. I would do well to protect myself. Due care is necessary, lest curiosity do its proverbial murder. And proper accessories would not go amiss. One of my rank must maintain certain standards after all. But I digress. Back to the original question. How would creation defend itself were we to come tomorrow? Time to find out. One of the areas that C20 did a lot of expansion in is in reworking the Thelane as sort of Fomorian changelings, which is kind of what they were before, but they also went along and reformatted the Fomorians a little bit too, where in C1st and C2nd, the Fomorians were an expression of banality. In C20, they're nightmare more than their banality, I think, and it really elegantly folds into the whole banality can be relative and glamour can be relative themes of the new book, as sort of exemplified by the Thelane seeming immunity and triggers being more or less dark mirrors of the regular Cathayn's seeming triggers and immunities. A thing that a Thelane finds glamorous or repulsive, maybe a thing that a changeling finds repulsive or glamorous. It just depends now.
There are still a couple remnants of that old design because they're kind of hard to excise. I feel like the House Balor immunity to cold iron, well, resistance to cold iron, is partially about that invocation that, oh, the Fomorians are banal, and House Balor is part Fomorian. And so now that's kind of left hanging out there as, well, what is this really invoking? What are we doing with this cold iron resistance now? Other than it just being like, holy crap, what's going on with Balor? They're creepy. but it doesn't have that same root invocation. With the exception of a couple little things like that, I really like the reframing a lot. One thing in the way that Simon was talking about, where what the Thelane represent may or may not be banal to a changeling, because they are the antithesis of a lot of changeling ideas, because they are destructive to things in the dreaming in a way that maybe the dreaming has always been. You know, it's wild. Things are created and destroyed, and maybe destroying the dreaming isn't as intrinsically banal as everyone thinks. It's just in this space of scarceness where the Fae are terrified that they're going to become extinct, that's a trigger for them. You know, if you suddenly see that as a possibility, then the Thelane being able to just destroy things because they're fundamentally Fomorian isn't banal, but Cathayn would still experience it as banal. So I think there's an interesting story you can tell where, in terms of your cosmological truths that inform how you make things happen systematically, there's nothing banal about the Fomorians. They're of the dreaming as much as anything else. They're just dark. But the Cathayn think there is. You can keep that story element from the previous editions if you want, but just keep it as a societal bias that maybe doesn't have any root in reality. I think there's a really interesting story to be told there.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the Fomorians and the Thelane not being evil as a human idea, as much as banal is a Fae concern, but them just being not our kind of Fae, because that's a framing that is very, very human, and putting it on something as inhuman as the Fae can be makes it a little bit easier to take it, turn it, look at it, examine it, take it apart. You can't really do that with evil. And in Changeling, you can't really do that with banal either.
Yeah, I agree. I'm actually not a big fan of evil as a concept. I always try to find the understandable root in my villains, even Nefandi. I want the Nefandi to make sense. I want the Dantane to make sense. And I think if you can do that, if you can get yourself in the really removed evil's a construct kind of idea and approach it that way and still be, I think they're terrible and toxic, but terrible and toxic are different things because what poisons me doesn't necessarily poison you. And I think that that's a much more interesting way to view banality and the things that either are banal or have a cultural reputation as being banal.
And there's a way to tie that back into the prequel material too, where the Cathayn and the other, we'll call them light changelings or light glamour changelings, are the descendants of the remnants of the Balorian Crusade who went native. The Fomorians and the Thelane are the descendants of Fae that came in with the Balorian Crusade who didn't go native and actually stayed more true to what they are.
Yeah, which is more or less the way I've always sort of read that. I say always, since reading Graceful Wicked Masks. The tidbits in Graceful Wicked Masks about the Fae who go native, who become obsessed with creation and kind of love what creation offers them, it's a really interesting and compelling model for the Tuatha'en as opposed to Fomorian Fae origins. It's just not all that well developed in Exalted, but it's there and you can play around with it. It's also interesting because those Fae are still really toxic. It's like, okay, well, they don't want to undo everything because atrocity of form. I guess that's a step up in the world. They're also like creepily addicted to reality and feed off of it and are ravaging machines. Not because they want to unmake everything, but because, oh my god, you're delicious. And looking at the Tuatha De Fe as having come from addiction to reality as opposed to atrocity of form destroy reality, I think is a better way to frame them, and it creates a more realistic, explainable space for why are Red Caps Tuatha again? Like, what are the Slua doing over here? Why are the Slua not part of the Fomorian dream? Because the nightmare, not nightmare divide that exists just through the modern lens ends up with some weird questions about like what makes these Fae not Thelane? And I think if you go back and look at that addiction as opposed to atrocity model, it maps forward a lot more elegantly.
Was a really, really dumb sci-fi that I really, really liked back in the, I think it was the late 90s, but it might have been the early 2000s, is called Andromeda. It was supposed to be a space opera in the.
Hercules in space?
Yeah, but let's get to the reason why I liked it. The first two seasons were written by this guy who I think was an occultist, and they did an interview with him after he got kicked off the show because Hercules' agent decided it should be Hercules in space. And he actually wrote a alternate ending to it as a script just because he was like, screw you guys, like this is what I was going to do with this story. And the whole thing ended up being a story about the tension between the perfection of reality from before the moment of creation and loving that, and the perfection of the absolute chaos of reality after the moment of creation and loving that. And that's kind of my Fomorian Tuatha lens.
That's a really interesting Fomorian Tuatha lens. I like that lens a lot. And now I weirdly want to go back and actually watch some Andromeda. Oh, what have
Oh,
you done?
it's a really bad show. It is a really bad show.
I'm
But
aware.
yeah, but like they had that one character, the pixie dream girl who was purple, and like in his version of the show, it was all about her because she was the avatar of a star, and all of the stars in this original plot were fragments of the cosmic consciousness from before, and they were the ones who created the universe sort of in rebellion against that original perfection because they wanted something different. But then, like, there was also the spirit of black holes, where all of the stars were individuals, all black holes are the same thing, and the black hole was supposed to be the expression of cosmic unity from before, but it's the warped, twisted love that's left over after the relationship falls apart and it goes toxic and stalkery. And that, for the Fomorians, is so much more interesting than we just hate everything.
Yeah, that's also I see why you think he's an occultist, because there's a lot of Kabbalah folded into that. There's a lot of Kabbalah invocation in the Fair Folk as well. But that makes the Fomorians make a lot of sense to me. And it also explains a fair bit of why they're able to go through and be as destructive as they are. Because they want that pure released glamour potential in its totally most abstract before atrocity of form state. Even if they don't remember that's what they're a manifestation of, that makes a lot of what they do make sense. And it also explains why the Cathayn would think they're banal when arguably they're rebelling against even that tiny little bit of banality that's necessary for like the Adheen to have form.
Right. It's sort of the idea that to the Cathayn, that homogeny that the before was, because nothing could be anything for more than, well, seconds didn't exist, but more than an eternity that didn't matter because that didn't exist either. And to the Fomorians, it's more concrete, more we understand this. The form itself is banal because, well, it is.
Yeah, once something has a form, fundamentally, it can't have all the other forms that that wild energy could have had. And, thinking of the sort of like the dark fae view as being, how dare you collapse into any limited form? And sure, the Thelane have that now because they were trapped, but that they want the total disillusionment back to that origin. Yeah, that's really compelling in a lot of ways. And I feel like it could be really interesting to tell a story about how that would manifest in their dreamers, in the really self-destructive ways that people view their fuck-ups. Like, oh my God, why does this existence thing have to happen? Because it always feels wrong. I think that, we've all either been that person at some point in our life or known people that just can't quite make existing feel like it fits. And I kind of like the idea that the Thelane turn their dreamers into that, or are drawn to people that have that predisposition. Because, going to the glamour side, there's never been really anything written on what do Thelane dreamers look like? What role do they play in society?
Yeah, there's that actually develops the banality being relative thing a lot better. If you look at it through that lens, you end up with the Thelane being attracted to or cultivating or creating people who nihilism isn't quite the word I want, but it's the one I have. It's not that they are nihilistic, it's that they express that concept very fully. Like, nothing matters, therefore, why is anything? Kind of a thing.
Yeah, and I've met people like that that are definitely banal. Nothing comes of it. I imagine the Thelane dreamers being like Thomas Ligotti or Edgar Allan Poe, or I have a particular friend from high school who I'm still somewhat connected with, and I won't name drop her, but she's kind of like that as well, and she's very aware of it and she manages it. But there's a certain type of person that is driven to, oh my God, nothing matters. The world is void and awful. And, there's no point in going forward. And yet I can't stop creating to try and make sense of that. And I don't want to. There's no purpose in anything I'm doing, but I can't stop myself from doing it. And that's kind of how I imagine a Thelane dreamer being. I can imagine confronting some Cathayan players with this. Yeah, no, this person should be banal. They shouldn't be able to create at all. But they are. And what does that mean? And yeah, you're still triggering. Have a nice day.
Yeah, that would be really rough. And like having people like that in the game would be a really good case for adding a banality trigger to the Thelane, like that just compels them to protect those people.
Yeah, which is its own kind of interesting specter-like behavior. I mean, I feel like talking through this, there's not a great death kith among the Thelane, which is bizarre. There should be, because the Slua equivalent bogies aren't connected to death. They're just connected to I'm disgusting. They're the Keramet, and they're part of like the Dark Fae broadly, but they live out in the dreaming. The Thelane really need a good necromantic kith, because that would give a hook between the Thelane and specters. And I feel like the intersection of like what specters do to humans and what Thelane would do to their dreamers needs to be a space that is inspected.
Yeah, and that kind of gets back to one of the points I've been kind of rolling around for using Wicked Masks as prequel material, because in Wicked Masks, in order to take on enough form to be a playable character, you had to use an assumption charm. And each of the assumption charms lines up with one of the feeding styles of the extant changelings. There's an assumption of dreams, which lines up with the Cathayn really neatly. There's an assumption of elements, which lines up with the Inanimae really well, and the Nunahi and other animist Galayn, kind of. And then there's, I don't remember what the other one was called. There was one that was like the assumption of praise or something. And that kind of lines up with the Cien. But then there was a fourth one, and it was the assumption of dead things. And that doesn't have a space in modern changeling outside of the Slua and the Nunahi, sort of, but neither of them gather glamour in that method. And I just kind of wonder what happened with that thought.
Yeah, I don't. My guess would be that thought was rooted in an idea that was originally about prequel and developed into something that was much more just focused on playable options in Exalted. I think with Exalted, especially Graceful Wicked, because that was second edition Exalted and the prequel status had officially been dropped at that point. There's a little bit of looking out for artifacts that maybe just don't map forward.
Yeah, I just really like the idea of having the ability to explore this space that isn't the Shadowland, but isn't the Dreaming, and is kind of both that place where death and destruction are kind of inherent in the creative process. Like, it gets back to the part of the World of Darkness that is going wrong by design, but at the same time, Changeling has that little kernel of hope in it. So it makes sense that at least somewhere in Changeling that would be working right.
I'm trying to imagine what that would look like, though, because yeah, I don't, I'd need to solidify that more in my head. I feel like there'd be a relationship there between Sandmen and changelings that have this relationship with death, and maybe even that changelings are able to play a role taking the dreams that humans have about their loved ones and distilling it into glamour and being part of that inspiration, worship, relationship, which kind of gets into, house rules you've written that pull the whole Hisien Yugen worship thing into a unified model. So I'm kind of thinking along those terms. I know it's not exactly the canon approach, but they have some relationship with that ancestor worship, inspiration, memories, and love devoted into, the dead, their, past loved ones, and they're able to cultivate that more completely than wraiths. And then maybe they have a relationship with Sandman where they can bring that sand to them and give wraiths access to like a whole realm of relationship with the living that they can't quite get on their own. There could be this really symbiotic back and forth, but they get to keep a little bit of that themselves. It's a really incomplete thought, and I don't know how many chronicles it would apply to, but I feel like there's a place for that existing.
Right. Like, I'm just really interested in the really core, like, what's going wrong with the World of Darkness thing ties into banality so strongly, because what's going wrong with the World of Darkness is stagnation. There's no actual release for anything. Nothing is returning to void and leaving space for new things to come about. Everything is strangling in its own sort of fetid vitality. And the Beleriand Crusade, you could argue, was sort of the last productive gasp of not the wild, because it's not really sapient in any way, but that sort of immune response the wild would have had. Like, oh, this creation thing has existed for a while. It should go away now so that something else can happen. And the descendants of that, like, not knowing why they're doing this, but they're doing it, kind of a thing.
And that's something I've always liked, the idea of the major aspects of the big primordial forces, you know, whether you believe in the triad thing or not, there'd be some breakdown, even if it isn't perfectly along those lines, of major primordial impulses in any kind of game where you have archetypical spirits, fae, whatever, and that they're part of a broader functioning system, but like red caps and that deep obsessive hunger has a role to play. It has a role to play in the hunger for vindication, the hunger for sex and recreation, the hunger for liberty and against the she. And yeah, it can go toxic and you can get crazy Nazi red caps like in the Skaha fiction. But when it's functioning, even though it still looks ridiculously dark when you look at it in isolation, when you step back and look at the overall system, you're like, oh, well, yeah, that's really unpleasant, but it's also necessary. And I like that idea that the primordial forces, they don't understand what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. They don't see the big picture, but they are fulfilling a purpose.
Right, and that's a little bit easier to get at with some of the Gallane, especially the animus types, like the inanimate. Nothing about this is written, but like your idea of there being a fungus inanimate makes a lot of sense because, yeah, funguses are really gross, and like sometimes you might get one high yeast infection, but at the same time, they do something that is intensely vital and important for the continuation of other parts of existence. It's just we find it distasteful.
Yeah, and there are a ton of them. I mean, there's so much fungus in the world. The largest organism in the world is a fungus. It's a mycelium culture that I think it's in Northern California. I'd have to double check on the location. You know, you don't see it most of the time because it just goes for miles and miles and miles underground. And you might occasionally see, you know, the mushrooms that come up and bud. And when they realize that, wow, these mushrooms and the mushrooms that are like five counties that way are genetically identical. Wait a second. You know, and so the idea of taking the Kubera concept and mapping it onto fungi, and yeah, oh God, fungus is disgusting. But it's also weird and compelling and has this funky cultural place in our world. Like, if you had a fungus equivalent to the Kubera, which, you know, the original anime book did say there are other kingdoms, we're not writing them up because limited word count, but they exist. You guys go nuts. Which is kind of where I thought, oh, let's just, what would they be? You know, like magic mushrooms. What would the Kubera of, or the fungus Kubera of the psychotropic mycelium networks, what would they be like? Like, there's just a lot of potential there.
Yeah, and it gets into that weird space where let's talk about dark glamour, but let's not talk about it too much or give you a very good idea of what makes it different from, light glamour. Is it nightmare? Is it something that's like nightmare but not nightmare? Is it like banality? Maybe it's one of those sections of the book that I read and immediately forgot, but I don't remember bumping into it.
They never really defined dark glamour in the book, other than to say it exists. There were surges of it during the Evanescence and subsequent dark glimmers. But that's about it. And I don't know if that was about limited word count or about not really wanting to put parameters around that.
At least they managed to introduce a lot of negative space for me to go nuts in.
Which, if I'm going to be honest, I kind of like negative space in Changeling. I feel like it's a game that benefits from not having too many systematic definitions.
Let no one tell you he knows history if he hasn't lived it. The people of Baelor were rulers of this land long before the other noble houses existed. Ours is blood of the most royal. Gideon may pretend to be the chosen leaders of the Fae all they like. We know the true story. All the Shi except House Baelor trace their origins back to the Tuatha De Danann. Only we claim an older kingship, an earlier rule, and a greater progenitor. Before the advent of the Tuatha De Danann, our people, the Fomorians, ruled the waves and received tribute from the people of Hibernia. We were born of the earliest settlers' dreams and terrors of all that they admired and feared, given shape from their most hideous imaginings. We became what they made us, strict overlords who accepted their adulation and their tribute, and who agreed to live apart from them on islands of our own. We govern the northern seas, preying upon anyone foolish enough to venture into our waters, and we struck fiercely and decisively against any who denied us our due as rulers of the Northwest Isles. Gradually, our first dreamers died out and were replaced by the Firbolg, who settled and farmed the land. At first, they resisted our rule, and a great battle drove many of them out. But when they returned in greater force, their king and warrior elite agreed to pay our tribute. In return, we used our magic to make their lands fertile and bless them with strong children. For long years we reigned, unchallenged and respected, if not loved, by all. Though we took the best that mortals produced as our tribute, we did not require much. We regarded them as our beloved subjects, even intermarrying with a few of their elite. Many came to us willingly as servants drawn by our glory. Then came the Tuatha De Danann.
So those are a lot of my and Simon's thoughts on glamour and banality as it's changed in C20 and some other vaguely adjacent plot ideas we have as well. We hope that we've given you some things that you can get some use out of, or just some perspectives that maybe you haven't thought of before, you know, and considering that, yeah, the landscape of what is banal and what is glamorous has changed. It hasn't totally wiped away some of what came before. So we hope you enjoyed the episode and that you'll come again for our next conversation on Walking Away from Arcadia.
The readings from today's conversation were from Changeling the Dreaming, 2nd edition by White Wolf Publishing, Graceful Wicked Masks, The Fair Folk by White Wolf Publishing, Pour l'amour et liberté, Book of Houses 2, by White Wolf Publishing. The music from today's conversation was LSD by Mon Plaisir, Tonhauser Gate by Tritachyon, Erosion Hydrique by Mathieu Lamontagne and Emmanuel Toledo, and Sad Walk with Sad Melodica by Comico. Today's poorly explained banality trigger. Cars.